From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is officially over.
All those in favor of the motion will say aye. Those opposed will say no. The ayes have it. This House is adjourned. Sign it aye.
The 2019 Georgia General Assembly session has come to a close. Sine die wrapped up around midnight with a traditional flare. Lawmakers threw papers into the air as Tuesday turned into Wednesday. GPB's politics reporter Stephen Fowler and GPB Lawmakers Capitol correspondent Donna Lowry were there. So we're especially grateful to have you both here this morning to get a recap of Sine die in the entire 40 days of an historic legislative session. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to be here.
Well, really glad to have you. So usual frenzy as the clock was ticking yesterday, and one of the final bills lawmakers passed governs the cultivation and distribution of medical marijuana. Here is Republican Representative Micah Gravley.
These families here have been fighting for 5 years. It made the best thing of the night was the fact that we know that this was not a measure that was contentious. It was supported by our governor. It was supported by our lieutenant governor, the Speaker of the House, who has been unwavering on behalf of these families.
So, Donna, what exactly does the bill allow and who likely to benefit?
Well, the big contention was whether or not how many dispensaries they would have, how many private licenses they would have. And right now we're talking 6 dispensaries. They will there's a limit on the amount of land that be used to be able to grow it.
To cultivate marijuana.
Actually, that was very much important in all of this. And then to be able to, within the next 12 months, to be able to actually get it to the point where it's in a form that people can use it. And right now, there are 8,400 people who are registered to be able to receive the cannabis oil. So the main contention, though, was whether or not how fast it could actually get into the state and whether or not people outside of the state who have been producing it can get it in here faster. And they're thinking 12 to 18 months at this point.
Senator Gravley sounded surprised that it was not contentious. It is a little surprising. You might not expect that a conservative legislature. Why not?
Yeah, I think that it's been 5 years in the making, and we have heard the stories over and over again of young children who've had 100 seizures a day down to 1 a week. We've heard the stories of people who have PTSD and different things that have been, just so painful to listen to those stories. And so I think finally the lawmakers realized we've got to do something. As long as we make sure we are not making sure we're, as long as marijuana does not become an issue in this state, that we're not getting to the point where we're like California and Colorado.
Right. Right. And that's one of the things throughout this and the hemp cultivation bill that went through that these Republican conservative lawmakers had to say repeatedly, this is not a gateway to marijuana. This is not a gateway to legalization of marijuana. This is not a gateway to, the drug, part of things. So it was kind of explaining to maybe some of their older colleagues and some of their more skeptical colleagues that these families with these medical conditions that are traveling thousands of miles, spending money out of their own pocket to essentially break the law for these health reasons are not the same as, trying to legalize recreational marijuana for everyone.
Well, Stephen, the medical marijuana bill and a few others were ironed out in conference committee. So could you walk us a little through that process, what these committees are and how they were used on this final day?
So, Virginia, picture, if you will, some old-timey legislators with their pocket watches and everything sitting around, and they have language like this where the House insists on its position on such and such bill, and the Senate insists on its position, and they have all these like flowery languages to basically say, we're not budging from our version of this bill. So there's a smaller committee of 3 House representatives and 3 senators that meet in the hallway in another committee room and away from all of the shenanigans of the larger bodies to hash out these differences. For some of these bills, that also involved a trip to the principal's office to sit down with Governor Kemp's team to figure out the differences of what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, things like that. We had the medical marijuana bill there. We had some other bills dealing with some hunting regulations that went to conference committee. A bill dealing with apprenticeship hours for cosmetologists that also had to go to a conference committee. So it's not just these big bills that have to go to these committees. Sometimes just differences are too hard to work out.
So, and then they bring it back to the floor after that.
Correct.
Well, while these conference committees were meeting, Hollywood actress Alyssa Milano held a press conference at the Capitol calling on Governor Kemp to veto HB 481, better known now as the so-called heartbeat legislation. Here's some of what she had to say.
We've been glad to bring billions of dollars in revenue to support Georgia's schools, parks, and communities. But we cannot, in good conscience, continue to recommend our industry remain in Georgia if HB 481 becomes the law.
How have these threats been received by the governor and Republicans in the state legislature?
Well, so what happened is Alyssa Milano came and delivered this letter to the governor's office. The governor wasn't there, but one of his floor leaders, Representative Dominic Larricchia, was there. And there's this video that kind of went viral of an exchange where the representative's like, "And what district are you from?" And so maybe some of these threats and boycotts or things aren't being taken seriously by Republicans in the legislature. I know Speaker Ralston said last week that, you know, he didn't expect Hollywood to try to tell him what Georgia values were. So there's a certain element of that. But there's also the local aspect and the local element. After Alyssa Milano spoke, a local woman who runs a prop set shop here in Georgia spoke about the impact of what this bill would do if Hollywood left and how it would impact her as a local Georgian participating in the economy here.
Now, I did see posts on social media from people on both sides urging people to call and weigh in on their opinions at the governor's office. But this does feel different than the religious liberty bill that then Governor Deal vetoed a couple years back. Back then, there were huge companies, organizations involved. Disney, which owns Marvel and Pinewood Studios. The NFL, which was then finding a home for the 2019 Super Bowl. Any of those big companies go on record for the heartbeat bill?
Well, there weren't any major companies that, those who did come in came in near the end. Businesses that really just wanted to have something to say after, I think they were called out by the media in a lot of cases. Why haven't you said anything? So we didn't hear from the major companies. This is different as a moral issue, as a social issue, I think, than religious liberty. And so I think, frankly, a lot of people are waiting to see what happens at the court level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why put it out there when you know this is probably going to court? It's
right. And I would also say that this is, because of the court, it's a different issue. Religious freedom, religious liberty, those bills have been enacted in different places and largely been upheld. But this abortion bill is being viewed by the sponsors and the governor and some other people as an angle to try to get in front of the Supreme Court. So maybe, you know, I don't think Marvel or Disney or some of these larger studios wants to necessarily be filing amicus briefs to the Supreme Court for or against Roe versus Wade, necessarily.
That's GPB Politics reporter Stephen Fowler. Lawmakers TV Capitol correspondent Donna Lowry is also with us, shedding some light on the final day of the legislative session and the session as a whole. Okay, so medical marijuana passed, as did a measure that would extend the time law enforcement is required to keep rape kits. Now, we've talked a little bit on this program about the testing backlog and destruction of kits, but Donna, could you recap that for us? Where did the bill come from, and what does it mean for victims?
This has been a long time thing. It's been several years in the making. And what we know is that sexual assault evidence has not been preserved, or it's been preserved for so long that it is no longer useful. And that means that crimes cannot be solved. So this allows for a shorter period of time for those rape kits to be available so that we're getting to the point where they can be used to solve the crimes. Because we were finding that there was quite a backlog of these rape kits.
So people were not being charged. In some cases, we even found that someone raped again when their evidence was in sitting in a holding cell somewhere. Okay, so, all right, let's get on to some other legislation. Some rural Georgia issues have been a priority for lawmakers and Governor Kemp ahead of this session. The House Rural Development Council, they met several times last year.
One of the bills that squeaked through just before the deadline would help with internet access. Stephen, can you break that down for us? What does it do?
So rural broadband is a big issue that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and the governor say that they wanted to tackle. And basically, there are large pockets of the state that don't have reliable internet access. And in the places that do, or maybe it's a little bit reliable, there's only one carrier. So if something happens, you are really out of luck. I've been talking to people across the state throughout the session about this issue. And the bill that passed would allow electric membership corporations to sell internet. And this is a good idea in the lawmakers' minds because these people, these entities sell power to these residents so they could use their existing infrastructure and the power to give internet to places that don't have the same speeds that larger metropolitan areas do. They passed a bill earlier in the section that would allow telephone cooperatives to do the same thing. The logic being, we can serve you with telephone and internet at the same time, and it's not building an entire new infrastructure for this.
Okay, so we've talked about the shenanigans that happened during the waning days of a legislative session. This session focused especially on what we'll call a Franken bill that would give a jet fuel tax break for Delta and potentially hand over control of Atlanta's airport to the state. How did this combination shake out?
Well, it didn't. So there was a conference committee for another vehicle for a bill that was an innocent bill that would do some sort of Georgia Department of Transportation changes for contracting. But the same House chairman that added on the first Franken bill added a bunch of stuff to this bill. If SB 200 were to pass, it would be this innocent bill. It would give the jet fuel tax break. It would also do this rural transit plan, and there would be no mention of the airport. But really, the issue of the airport takeover and the tax break was just so toxic for both chambers that nothing has ended up happening for all of those. So no airport takeover, no legislative oversight of the airport, no tax fuel break, jet fuel tax break for Delta, and no idea what's going to happen next session.
All right. So during this session, Donna, you spoke with Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms about the proposed state takeover. Here's some of what she had to say.
I understand concerns about perception, but then there's also reality. And what I would say is that when you live in a glass house, you shouldn't throw stones. The state's had its own challenges. And this notion that the state needs to come in and take over and that the state can do it better is not founded upon anything other than presumption.
The mayor also called the state's attempt to oversee the airport an act of war. So what do you think about her reaction to the bill and the way it played out, which is didn't happen?
I think that she landed the right blows. She pointed it back at them and said, listen, look at what's happened at the state level, some problems that you've had that you haven't been able to take care of. And I think they looked at themselves and wondered whether or not they could do a better job of that. Plus, we always understood that the House Speaker and the governor did not really like this idea of an airport takeover. So they really didn't have the momentum there. And so when they tried the oversight authority for the airport, they added these other 9 airports across the state. Those airports were blindsided by that. And I think that killed that part of it. In the end, by yesterday, that part had been taken out, and we thought there's just the jet fuel exemption and this effort to help with rural transit would come through, and that never happened. I think the most surprising thing about this legislative session is there was no package that dealt with transit, no transportation package at all.
And, you know, one quick thing I'll add is that this really sets up the stage for rural Georgia versus urban Georgia, increasingly Democratic versus Republican areas. And we'll see this through the next 3 years of the governor's tenure.
Well, let's pick that up in the next segment. We're taking a quick break and we're going to get to the wrap of the legislative session and an overview of the session, which was an historic one indeed. Stay with us for more of On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler and lawmakers' Capitol correspondent Donna Lowry. Had a long day under the Gold Dome yesterday, or should I say until this morning, for Sine Dye, and still made it into the studio. So happy to have them both. Stephen, I want to pick up with what you were talking about, the political realities in Georgia. Real urban-rural divide, red state with solidly blue metro areas. Republicans control all three branches of government, strongest positions of power in the legislature, and pretty much an iron grip on the courts. But most people in the state's largest city are Democrats. How is this all playing out over other matters in the legislature?
Well, I think what you've seen, that SB 200 Franken bill that we talked about before is a good example. You had a provision in that original version of the bill that a minority group of Republican lawmakers in Gwinnett County wanted to add in a provision to stop a martyr referendum from happening for another 7 years. And so the rest of the urban lawmakers and things like that that have the majority in Gwinnett County and in most of metro area said, no, that's a bad idea. And so Republican leadership ended up taking that out. You don't see a lot of Republicans in these urban areas. And as you look ahead to the 2020 election, you've got the presidential election and other things like that. There's this calculus of bills of making sure that Republicans don't only represent parts of rural Georgia. And I think some of the bipartisan issues that you've seen, medical marijuana, for example, is an effort done by Republicans to show that it's not just, rural issues and that we only care about rural Georgia and not urban Georgia. And I think the airport takeover not happening is another example of maybe that divide being narrowed just a little bit.
How do Democrats fare this session?
Actually, I just spoke with a couple last night and I said, what grade would you give? And one said B plus and one said a B, which surprised me. And the feeling between them was a bit, because we fought back on a few things, even though we lost on things like they felt abortion and hate crimes bill, things like that, they still feel that they got their word out and the state is turning and they are going to be able to pick up some seats the next time around. And that is a win for them.
Well, let's talk about the abortion, the heartbeat bill that has really captured a lot of national attention. As we said, you know, Hollywood has gotten in, those who are in the industry threatening a boycott of Georgia if this bill passes. So we know it's on the way to Governor Kemp for a signature or veto. But I'd like to dig into the process of debating such an inflammatory and controversial issue. Here's Democratic State Senator Valencia C.
This one is egregious. I mean, we've gone from 20 weeks, which back then I thought was horrendous, but today, 6 weeks? Come on, 6 weeks, many women don't even know they're expecting. It's mean.
So talk a little bit about her comments. A mean chamber. Did we see that in the Senate?
I think we definitely did, and she's not the only one who felt that way, that the feeling was we're going to just ramrod over you, we're going to roll over you, we're going to get what we want, we have certain priorities, and we're not going to pay attention a lot to what you have to say. She's been in the legislature for 19 years, and she said that it was the meanest legislative session she's been through. Right. Despite that, like I said, other Democrats feel that they did accomplish a few things.
But over in the House for this abortion debate, the first time it came up, this is where you saw House Democrats turning their back on the sponsor, bringing coat hangers and bleach to the floor, and people chanting shame after the votes. Speaking of mean or other things, that was their form of protest. But Republicans in the House actually had an ethics opinion drawn up to say that turning your back on a member in the well or things like that was violating the decorum of the House. And so you have debate. You have these emotional debates that happen that, generally speaking, things can get heated, emotions can get high. But this year, I think what you saw is that next step of really lawmakers seeming to take it personally when somebody was for or against this heartbeat bill.
All right. Want to point out that our listeners keep us honest. Lila Joynert tweeted, Pinewood Studios in Atlanta, not owned by Disney. It is a majority owned. Let's see, 69% by Dan Cathy, the owner of Chick-fil-A. We're fact-checking on that, but thank you so much for that, Lila. Governor Kemp, right after that contentious debate in the House, held a press conference, staked his position and support for this proposal. But we've also heard threats of boycotts from people involved in TV and film. How confident are you that Kemp will sign this into law?
He ran during his campaign saying that he was going to pass the toughest abortion laws in the country, and this piece of legislation would do that. If there's one thing that Kemp's team has been hammering behind the scenes and things like that, is that the governor is going to do exactly what he says he does, whether it's on abortion or health care or education or things like that. So he will sign it. It's just a matter of when. Now, he's not going to do a press conference today signing the bill. He's not going to do it this week, but he will sign this into law, and there will be a lawsuit as soon as that's signed.
Yeah, he did say, I can't govern because I'm worried about what someone in Hollywood thinks about me. He's on record for saying that. But what is the process here? After a legislation comes from the General Assembly to the governor, it has to go through a legal vetting process, right?
Yeah, but the governor has 40 days in which to sign the legislation. That's under law. And May 12th is that date for this year. And then the laws, most of them will take effect on July 1st.
Well, let's get a sense of how Governor Kemp has done. This is his first year in office for a Republican governor. His governorship, he laid out his policy plans during his inauguration. And I'd love to get a sense of how much of that plan he's actually accomplished. Here's just an excerpt from his State of the State address in January.
This is the largest pay increase for teachers in Georgia history and serves as a sizable down payment on my promise to ultimately raise pay by $5,000.
Okay, how's the session turned out for Kemp's health priorities?
Well, so speaking, education was one of the
things. Yeah, sorry, let's go back to teacher pay.
Yeah, absolutely. $5,000 he promised in that he during his campaign. He's got that $3,000 down payment. Teachers are thrilled. They were able to expand that to include counselors and librarians and those people in the school system. So definitely big with that. There's also a lot with school security that he was able to do. And that was major, you know, starting an anti-gang task force, $69 million for school security overall, for individual schools to get about $20,000 each to work on school security. So when it came to education, he did a really good job of deciding what he wanted to do and getting there.
Well, it related to education issue. The fuel tax has been a controversial issue, right? That did not pass this time. Clayton County relies on airport taxes to fund its schools. This issue got caught up in protests against NRA after the Parkland shooting last year, but don't need to go revisit that. But Donna, can you explain how the business and education angles of a legislation like that?
Actually, it has been Clayton County bumping up against the city of Atlanta on that whole everything involving the airport. It's obvious they're not getting along. But that money is so important to Clayton County, which has had some struggles in recent years in terms of its education system. So it really needs that money to come in and wants to fight Atlanta over every step of the way when it comes to that.
Well, we'll have to wait until next time on that one. But Stephen, with the rise in school shootings in the U.S., the Georgia lawmakers also address school safety. What kind of changes will kids actually and administrators actually see any differences in schools?
Well, you know, one of the bills that made it through yesterday on sine die is this SB 15. It's a school safety bill that would require schools to update a lot of their threat assessments and threat plans for lockdowns and school shootings and things like that. And there was a lot of debate over that because there were some provisions that lawmakers felt went a little too far into surveillance and maybe criminalization of some, you know, teenage misbehaviors and things like that. But this school safety bill would require schools to basically be prepared and be more updated. And you pair that with the $69 million in school safety funding that school districts will be able to use as they see fit, and partner that with the anti-gang task force, and you're going to see a different school safety landscape in Georgia. But we're not really sure what that's going to look like because, as Kemp said on the campaign trail, and as Republicans often say, it's a local control issue and a local thing. So what happens in Banks County is going to be different than Butts County is going to be different than the city of Atlanta.
Well, we'll keep looking to you for that. Donna, I know you cover education extensively. That is Donna Lowry, our lawmaker Affairs TV Capitol correspondent. Also with us, GPB politics and news reporter Stephen Fowler, giving us some light on the final day of the legislative session and looking over the entire session. Stephen, something that you have been watching for a long time, even before the session, election security. Where does that stand the day after signing day?
Well, the governor has not yet signed HB 316 that would overhaul the state's voting system and new machines and make election law tweaks and things like that. But that hasn't stopped the Secretary of State's office from going ahead with a request for proposal process for those new voting machines. Now, there are about four or five vendors that are hoping to get that contract, the $150 million towards the machines and education and stuff. And there's a pretty extensive RFP process of forms they have to fill out of, you know, how many machines can you put and how quickly and how much will it cost? And I downloaded all the documents, put it up on our website, and there's even a little cost calculator Excel spreadsheet that if you plug in the numbers, it will tell you how much it's going to cost the state. So that process is ongoing, and at some point soon in the next month or so, the Secretary of State's office is going to announce who the contractor is, and we're going to move forward quickly.
It's going to have to be quickly.
Because there's going to be a pilot project of some of the machines in the November 2019 local municipal elections so that they can roll it out in time for the presidential primaries in 2020 and then the presidential election in 2020. But the biggest piece of that isn't necessarily the machines. It's going to be the education of how is how we vote different than the last time we voted.
That's a big rollout there. So Governor Kemp, of course, a Republican, the legislature controlled by Republicans. Are we likely to see that many vetoes?
I don't think you would necessarily see a veto per se. There may be some bills on his desk that he doesn't make a big fanfare about or doesn't, you know, do the big fancy pen signing multiple times, giving it to the sponsor. But largely this session, somebody from the governor's team said Monday before the session ended that they feel like they got 95% of what they were asking for, with the jet fuel tax break probably being most of that last 5%. So everything that you're seeing on the governor's desk is from a Republican-controlled House and a Republican-controlled Senate. So he's, you know, riding pretty high. He likes everything that he's going to be seeing on his desk. It's just a matter of what he chooses to highlight as part of his Georgians First, keep chopping, healthcare, education-focused plan.
We didn't talk that much about healthcare. How about the Medicare waiver plan that's gone forward?
You know, what you could see is Republicans angling themselves as healthcare leaders in Georgia legislative policy, and what this would do, he's already signed it, it would create, have these consultants spend some time and some money evaluating Georgia's healthcare systems to find ways that they can exempt themselves from the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid to expand health insurance access to little pockets of people across Georgia that don't currently have that access. And you have the medical marijuana cultivation and some other things. And so Kemp's health care policy is something that on the trail, there wasn't really a whole lot on his website and a whole lot that he talked about. But now that he's in office, we're seeing that as a through line of one of his policies that he's championing.
And also, it's become a priority for the Republican Party.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen it nationally. And I think he really wants to put his stamp on it. He wants to call it his plan. You know, he came up with Patients First Act, and so I think he definitely wants to leave that as a legacy from his time in office.
So we probably aren't going to see that many vetoes, it sounds like, but how the governor signs a bill makes a statement. He may sign a controversial bill behind closed doors, for example, or group it with just 10 others, or maybe hold a big signing ceremony and press conference to, you know, laud his party's accomplishments. What do you think is going to get ceremonial treatment this year?
Now, I have been told that one of the things, this bill signing time is going to coincide with the governor's 100 days in office. So I've been told that the governor is going to get out of Atlanta and sign some pieces of legislation maybe outside of his fancy Capitol office. And he's going to go across Georgia and talk to communities and talk about his priorities and talk about what got finished. So I would imagine, you know, the budget will be signed probably at a school because of the full funding of QBE and all of the education things in there. maybe at a healthcare facility or something to signify that. But, most of them will be in the ceremonial office with the ceremonial pens and the ceremonial gaggle of reporters documenting everything.
Yeah. So that is the thing. In Georgia, the governor has some line item veto powers.
One of you explain that to me, line item vetoes?
That is where there is something in particular within a bill that he can veto, I believe. I honestly don't know as much about that as you might, Stephen.
Well, the line item veto is something especially rare, I would say, legislatively speaking, because, the governor doesn't, stare over lawmakers' shoulders and say, you should take that out before it gets to my desk. But when there's a consensus among Republicans in the governor's chair and in the House and the Senate, usually you won't see legislation that he doesn't necessarily like.
Mm-hmm. Governor Deal did it just a couple of times. We know that. All right, so wrap up here. The legislature was in session for 14 hours, voted on approaching 100 bills. Is that normal?
Apparently so. This was my first year actually being there for the entire 40 days. And apparently that last day they put off a lot. And watching all the sausage being made was kind of interesting, with all the different groups converging and coming up with ideas with each other. So, yes, I think that is pretty normal that they did that this time.
And I would say it was a little bit hard to keep track, because it wasn't just we vote on House Bill 1. It's we vote to agree to the substitute of House Bill 1 as amended by the Senate on last Thursday wearing green socks.
Exactly.
But we made it.
You're learning the language now, Donna.
Exactly.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us. Really appreciate your time and all of your thoughtfulness on the trail.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's politics reporter Stephen Fowler, Lawmakers TV Capitol correspondent Donna Lowry. The pair shedding a lot of light on this legislative session for us. Now, stay with us. We're going to talk with a couple of female veterans about their particular challenges. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stick around. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 93,000 women veterans live in Georgia. Once returned from active service, many face issues assimilating: child care access, employment, health care, even homelessness. The VA has slowly introduced more services for women veterans, like the Women Veterans Office here in Georgia, but there is more to be done. With me now is Bridgette McCoy. She's vice chair of the City of Atlanta's Veterans Affairs Commission and CEO of Women Veterans Social Justice Network. Welcome, Bridgette.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And also here is Vita Brooks. She's director of the Women Veterans Office with the Georgia Department of Veteran Services. Hello, Vita.
Hello.
Thanks so much for coming in, both of you. Both Army veterans, correct?
Yes, correct.
Now, Vita, I'm going to start with you. Women veterans are not always the first thought when we think groups of veterans or veterans services. Why do you think that is?
A large part of that is because women don't always identify as a veteran.
Why not?
Because when it's been ingrained in us that when you think of a veteran, you think of someone who is big and male and is fighting on the front line.
Hmm.
And socially, we believe that the women are behind the men and the men are in front protecting them. That is the image that I believe that America is comfortable with. So to change that culture and let them know that women are fighting next to men, that we are not that far from them on the battlefield, it's a slow process. But we are veterans and we're out there and we have the same leadership skills and abilities that our male counterparts have. But I don't think it's viewed that way.
Yeah, maybe our image has not kept up with what's actually going on in the culture.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't be the first time that that has happened. But you run the Women Veterans Office here in Georgia. This was founded just 2 years ago, 2017. Why is it important to have an office specifically for women veterans?
Well, first, I just want to give credit to Commissioner Roby, because he realized that we have a subpopulation, which are women veterans, and those specific needs of women veterans needed to be addressed. So when he developed the office and our team, he just really understood what type of support we were going to need. And so it's important, because when I when you go out and a female veteran applies for a job, it's important that they understand that those leadership skills are important on their resume. It's difficult for any veteran. You're a tank driver. It's hard to transfer that to a civilian job. There's not a whole lot of tank driving going on. So we have to help them understand what that means in the civilian world.
Mm. Brigitte, I'm wondering, women veterans, fastest growing demographic using VA services, but the VA hasn't always been welcoming to women. So what was it like for you? What were your interactions with the VA when you got out of the service?
Oh, they were very limited. I think probably the year that I got out was maybe a year before the law. They had changed the law to actually have women, gendered services, which was like in the early 90s, like 90, 91. And so most people don't realize that someone had to go to Congress to fight to change some of the policies within the VA so that would be made available. But when I got out, I didn't even know that had happened. So I did not use the VA. It was some, 15, 20 years later that I used the VA. And it was only after I was insurance poor. Basically, I was working a job, paying insurance, and could not afford the co-pays and the medical to be able to go to the doctor. So I started utilizing the VA. So it wasn't that it was welcoming. There was nothing ever that was a draw for me. So that's, pretty much was my experience coming out of the military in the 1990s.
Vita, does that sound common to you that women don't use it until, pretty much their back's up against the wall or they have to?
Yes, that is true. And it's because the environment was not inviting when they went 15, 20 years ago. And so once you mark the box that the place you've gone into is not user-friendly, you just decide it's not worth going back. But then when your back is against the wall, at least you have some health care.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Brigitte, this is something that particular to your experience, but has been a unfortunately, we've heard a lot about the experience of sexual assault inside of the military service. And you've spoken out a lot about how the military has handled that as a survivor yourself. How were you treated when you came forward about that?
So I first want to say there within the military, there are great people serving. There is much more people just doing their job and not assaulting people. And the challenge is we want to remove the people who are assaulting the serial rapists and the serial assaulters. And so for me, coming out of the military and going into the VA, being 20 years later, it was only at a screening that they were starting to do back in 2007 or 8, where they were asking directly, did you feel safe? Those kinds of things. And, it was odd to me, but I felt like maybe it was important to say yes, because that was my experience. And then that started me on a path to getting the appropriate mental health care. But in that process, I became homeless again and was going through a divorce and had a severe relapse in some of my other medical conditions. And so that accelerated the rate of me getting care. But if I would have just been someone who just, has a job and just going back and forth to work, I don't know that I would have gotten as much care as quickly are as intensely as I did because of my situation with being homeless and having other medical conditions exacerbating the post-traumatic stress.
However, even if it is more rare than not, you have helped women file claims about military sexual trauma. So what has it been like to get these claims filed? As you said, 2006, 2007, it feels like there was a lot more awareness about the problem then.
So by 2008, once I realized that the situation was as grave as it was, I was online. I had met all of these wonderful women who had served during Vietnam and all of those eras pre my service, and they had experienced sexual trauma. And so I thought, well, maybe I can use technology to connect with other women who've experienced this. And I started a page on Facebook, and that's really how WVSJ started. And from that page, I didn't necessarily help people in that, like, I did their claims for them. I just basically gave them information and resources and plugged them in with other people who knew how to process claims to help them in that process. And so in about 2008 through 2010, we were just still getting our claims denied left and right. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And about 2011, after going to D.C. and really pushing to change some of the policy, we had a breakthrough, and they decided to make some changes. And from that those changes, the claims began to be appropriately adjudicated based on markers in the experiences that people had had. They might not have had a police report, but they had markers in their military file that showed they went from being a really great, you know, top shelf soldier or airman, and then something happened. Nobody knew what it was, and then all of a sudden they were missing work and having problems. And so we were able to help so many women and men, for that matter, mm-hmm. be able
men
to.
Men are also victims of this, or survivors of this, I should say. Yes. Vita, you're nodding, so this is something that comes up a lot in your work?
Yes, it is. Our department, we file those claims.
Yes.
And it does come up. And they are looking for markers now. One of the things that is important for us at GDVS is that we also recognize that sometimes when someone is sexually assaulted, the only way to get their power back is to overachieve. And so we cannot discount the person who reports, but then they have this stellar record because that's the way they win. And so it is very important that we just recognize that this is not just recognize it's a problem, but appropriately respond to the call for help. There is nothing worse than walking into a VA hospital or clinic and saying, I am a survivor of MST and I need some help. And then someone asks you for a piece of paper, a DD-214, right. or a diagnosis or anything. I don't need to go to eligibility. I need someone to talk to me so that I don't become one of the other statistics, which is the unfortunate increase rate that we have in suicides. And so it is definitely an entire environment change that we need.
Yeah, I'm looking at data that says from the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs reporting that there were more than 6,000 veteran suicides each year between 2008 and 2016, an absolutely staggeringly unsettling and really unhappy statistic. That just most recently spoke is Vita Brooks. She is director of the Women's Veterans Office, and also with us, Bridgette McCoy. She is vice chair of the City of Atlanta's Veterans Office. Vita works for the state office. Well, obviously, this is, you know, MST, as you called it, military sexual trauma, a big issue facing women returning home from the service. But you also mentioned finding a job is difficult. Isn't this one of the things that we think of as an on-ramp to a great career, being in the military? You're either going to go to school, you're going to find something. Why has it been so difficult, do you think, for women veterans in particular?
It's been really difficult because what we're finding is that those women are coming out much younger. You do a few tours in Afghanistan or Iraq, and then you're ready to come home. We're also seeing, unfortunately, an increase in divorce rates while on active duty, mm-hmm. which means that produces a lot of single parents coming out. And so if you are a single parent and you're looking for work and you have no income coming in, there is a unique survival box that you check. You must survive. You have to take care of your children. So you put off taking care of your mental health. You put off taking care of your physical health. And so when you combine all of those things, whether you are male or female, it is a problem. Translating what you did in the service, I was a combat medic. When you come back to the civilian world, I have to translate that and so that someone who's reading my resume understands. When I talk about a soldier or a veteran talks about being a squad leader, corporate in general doesn't understand mm-hmm. what that entails. So it is the truth is when you leave the military, you don't even speak the same language as your civilian counterparts. Uh-huh. There are things we say and there are things that are done in the service that if I were just talking to you military, you'd be very unsure if I can actually communicate with the general population and how would that translate to that veteran being the face of my company. So there are a lot of things that need to be addressed in the out processing, in the transitioning.
Right. But I can also see those things, those qualities making great leaders and great workers. You know, somebody who has discipline, somebody who's used to showing up, someone's used to proving themselves. Yes, Bridgette.
Can I say something to that?
Yeah.
I think the other challenge is when you serve in the military, everything that you need to know about the person that you're looking at is physically on them. Their rank tells you where they sit. They have patches on that tell you what unit they're from. And pretty much, you know, you can ascertain, you know, if they're working in an office, that's where they work. So all of those things are like cues to you. And so when you leave the military, everything is decentralized. You no longer have everything that you need at your fingertips on the base. Now you have to figure out where everything is. So that adds a complexity to it. And then now you're going into the workforce. Most veteran military personnel don't necessarily know how to network. So then there's an added, you know, challenge. And then with the way that things are now, things like LinkedIn and social media add another complexity. And so if you already don't know how to translate your skills, you're not networking, then it's going to put you at a slight disadvantage. You can have a better advantage if you know how to use those things, but who's going to tell you how to do it?
Right.
Because the people who think they know how to do those things don't always know how to translate it to how to do it for somebody who's coming from the military. So it's a very, there are things that are challenging, but there's hope within this process, because I believe that women veteran are the greatest untapped resource that our nation has. I feel like with the right tools, the right resources, and the right funding for programs and services to professionally develop women veteran, you will definitely have the type of people that you need to make your, you know, get your company to have the great revenue that it needs and to have a beautiful brand. I mean, we automatically have the leadership. We can, you know, handle things in difficult situations. So help us to take that and you know, create these opportunities within the community to you know, put women veteran forward. I think that some of the challenges are focused on. Suicide is a big issue. It's a public health issue. But if you have the money to take care of your family, if you can pay your light bill, if you're not trying to boil water to, you know, heat water in your home, I mean, things that really create, stress to somebody who already has a medical and mental health issue. If we can remove a lot of those barriers, a lot of the challenges, like in my case, a lot of those challenges will be ameliorated. And so that's most of the work that I do, trying to make sure that women veteran are put forward. I mean, that's a big, you know, hairy goal. But I think as Americans, we're ready for, you know, we're ready to do this. This is something that if everybody knows that that's what we need to do, then we will dig in and get it done.
Well, I'm wondering for you, Vida, thank you so much for summarizing that so beautifully, Bridgette. But for you, Vida, you are working statewide. Access is a difficult thing for a lot of people, especially in rural counties in Georgia. How do they get to these kind of services that Bridgette was describing?
Absolutely. And that's where networking comes in, and partnering with veteran organizations show that the VA may not, it is not, first of all, you have to understand that the VA has they have a mission, and none of that mission includes transportation. It was not built in. So we really are looking at how do we reach out to service organizations to help transport people from the rural areas over to where they can get some help. The other thing is also, how do we market a way for civilian practitioners to be trained to understand the military culture so that they can then turn around and we don't have to pick you up and drive you 2 hours because there's someone in your community who already understands. It's an education part. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We've opened up a lot of big topics here and hopefully seeded some good discussion. But I really want to thank you, Vida Brooks, Director of the Women's Veterans Office with the Georgia Department of Veterans Services, and Bridgette McCoy. She's Vice Chair of the City of Atlanta's Veterans Affairs Commission, CEO of the Women Veterans Social Justice Network. Thank you both.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for our show today. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Be back again tomorrow with On Second Thought.